Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everyone, welcome to Wandering DMs. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today on Wandering DMs, we're going to be talking about how do you introduce new characters to your game, which is a surprisingly tricky subject, actually. And we have, myself and Paul have wrestled with this for a number of years, actually. It's come up on a number of blogs lately as far as problems that people have had with it, surprising problems, actually. And that can involve both just like a new player in a session for the first time, or it can be what if you need to replace a character mid-session.
Yeah, there's, it's a very situational problem, right? Like there's, you know, depending on whether it's a one-shot or an ongoing campaign, and right, the reasoning, you know, do we see it coming a week ahead of, in advance, or you know, did it just suddenly happen at the table and we weren't totally prepared?
Right. Yeah. And it's also a very fourth wall breaking issue.
Yeah.
I think one of the main thing that I'm thinking about is if someone's really committed to a particular storyline, this real world interruption is something you're going to have to try to iron out. A lot like when a TV show loses an actor.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. So one big example I can think of this that anyone can go look at if they want is this happened famously on Critical Role, where a character died, and it was clear, you could tell from the actors' faces, that nobody anticipated that happening.
Right.
And then that actor rolled up a new character and I think missed an entire session, basically. There was a whole session where he wasn't even on screen, and he came in. Talison Jaffe came missed a session, and then the following session came in.
Right, and what I was seeing from I guess the AD&D Facebook group, I think about a week ago, a less well known DM saying a player lost their character one session, and they made up a new character, and they said, "I will work you into the story at an appropriate time." Mm-hmm. Three sessions later. So apparently that player came week one and never got any activity. Week two didn't participate. Week three didn't participate. And in week four, the DM finally said, someone cast a monster summoning spell, mm-hmm. and the monster summoning spell summons the new character in like week three or week four or something like that.
That's crazy. I mean,
and they were like, that's a pretty good solution, right? Said that DM, I'm pretty happy with how I finally came up with something
wow.
to work them.
Wow. I mean, I cringed at the one session in Critical Role of the character
right.
missing. And here you have actors who like know that they're trying to pull the other person in because it's important to their show.
Yeah.
I even thought, like, probably I was going to cut them a bigger break because I'm thinking, well, then in this case, because they are a professional show and they have an audience, that they you know, the narrative perhaps trumps the enjoyment of a single player.
Whereas, right.
We're playing, like, I don't want someone sitting around bored waiting for them to come into the game.
Exactly. And I could also see with Critical Role, like, actually, like, a positive tension. Like here's a session where you want to see this player participant,
right.
and we're actually not going to give it to you to heighten the tension of when he does come back. I could imagine, but yeah, if you're playing and you know it's not a professional
yeah.
situation, I agree. It's that seems both of those situations seem surprising.
Yeah, my read of the Critical Role situation was that Matt Mercer had planned a specific scene where he would come back in and.
Gotcha.
You know, probably between the sessions prompted the players of like, you know, a little bit of information about where and when and how it would happen. So they were geared towards pushing towards that, or at least maybe even if he didn't prompt them, they could kind of detect through play that like, oh, that's probably where the new character will come in. But they just sort of let the play evolve and get to that point. Right.
Yeah.
The players didn't like make a hard left turn to make it happen right away.
Yeah. Yeah. So I feel like, in the past, I feel like I've made mistakes in the same vein. Like I've done things and again looked for story reasonable moments to bring a new character in and then later regretted how long it took. For me, that wasn't whole sessions. That was like maybe an hour or two. Yeah. And the main thing that I'm thinking about actually is when I was running Descent in the Depths of the Earth, and you were playing, and your character put on the cloak of the poisonous cloak.
Oh, I remember that. Yep.
Instant death, no save.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And you know, in those series of modules, they have places whereby there's possible allies or there's a prisoner that might be joining the party. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, great, there are a couple counters from now. I know that there's some people that actually could join the party. I'll let him take one of those. But it took maybe an hour and a half to get there, and I felt really bad about you not being active for that time.
So, I mean, the funny thing is I've likewise been in the same situation, I think. I can't think of a specific case, but I do remember being DM and, like having maybe some ideas of how to work in the new character, right. And after an hour or so of play being like, I'm just going to have to do something ham-fisted here because they're not going there. They're not going to the spot where it feels good.
And yep.
I thought that's where you were going to go with that summoning spell anecdote, because I thought, like, oh, finally the DM just snapped and was like, fine, you can't summon monster, and there he is.
Right. Well, I think that they said, I mean, I think that was what they did. It's just that it took them 3 weeks to get to that point.
That's crazy. Which, I can't imagine.
Yeah, which seems unfortunate to
me. I think, in general, my opinion would be that the enjoyment of all the people that you've brought to your house or whatever, that into your group, trumps the narrative. Like, we're here to have fun and play a game.
I agree now, and I almost think that, like, maybe many of us need to step in this bear trap. Like, maybe many of us need to step in this bear trap and feel bad about it afterwards before we realize that. And I think that also maybe this is a trap that's easier to fall into with the thesis that as a DM you're a storyteller. I'm telling a story, and it's a story. And if that's the case, then this story possibly trumps, you know, other issues like, did everybody that came to your house get involved? So I think that maybe this particular issue that kind of breaks a fourth wall forces you to think about, is player participation going to trump the story for you? And I think it should. And I think that's a sign that, like, what we're doing is not always telling a story.
I mean, I feel like it reminds me a lot of the sort of you wrote a blog post about this, and is it just the golden rule of D&D?
Yes,
right.
That's what I call it.
Can you quote that off the top of your head? Because
playability trumps realism, basically. So if you do have, I mean, the best thing of all is if you have a rule or mechanic that both simulates reality and makes for really good, smooth gameplay. But if there's a tension or if there's a fight, I personally am going to come down on gameplay wins.
Right.
Even if it hurts me on the realism side.
I mean, and
there is a quote in Gygax's DM's guide. Gygax said a lot of stuff, but there's a particular line that I pull up that I feel embraces that.
You know, the funny thing is, you know, playability trumps realism. The thing I really liked about your blog post is that you then quickly point out that, like, that doesn't mean realism is out the window, right? In fact, it's right there in the number two slot of most important things, right? Like, it's still quite important. So likewise, I would say, you know, enjoyment of the group trumps the narrative. The narrative is still important. I think it's still important that we try not to break the fourth wall or that we, you know, move past that quickly and not dwell in the uncomfortableness.
Super well put. super, super well put. And that was exactly the point of that blog post. That was exactly right. Is that they both should be on the table. They both should be honored. And only in that critical pinnacle moment, if you must pick a winner, does playability narrowly win out.
So let's take a step back and talk about the times when you have foresight, right? So you have a special guest, somebody's in town for this week and wants to join the game and everybody's down for that or whatever it is. How do you deal with that?
So, see, I feel that my methodology, I'm pretty happy with what I do of generally require players to return to town. And this, at least, right. And at least with my campaign, there's a pretty good churn in players. Is there there's a core of maybe three, four players who are I can pretty much depend on there. And then there's another one, two, three players who are about 50-50 or so.
Interesting.
And so that really supports, you know, character A, B, C. They got drunk. They went missing. They're on a side quest. I don't know. They just didn't show up. Mm-hmm. And you can you know, reform who's going on the expedition every single time very, very conveniently that way. I feel like if people are doing the camp in a dungeon thing, you run into this problem of who disappeared and who reappeared a lot more. And so for me, basically going back to town pretty much solves that problem all the time.
Interesting. I mean, going back to town every session isn't... I mean, I do that in my West Marches because, of the, again, the necessity because of the constant shifting, not only constantly shifting player base, but the shifting goals from one week to the next. The party has wildly different goals. But I don't know. Maybe that's worth a whole separate discussion about that, because I think that it also there are cases where I prefer the continuity of just we pick up every week where we left off exactly last week, and you don't have to keep going back to town.
Okay.
I think one thing I'm noticing in the West Marches, for example, is that I can't really have very large dungeons because the players continually re-experience those first couple of rooms over and over and over.
Okay.
Which is not terrible, but like, then why did I bother setting up those deeper rooms that are harder to get to because they'll never get there?
Why is that taking time? Like, so do they still have to fight through the first couple rooms?
Well, yeah, because it's a living dungeon, and I assume that when the party is gone, the monsters do things.
Okay, so I actually really soft pedal that. Actually,
really?
my dungeons basically stay empty-ish.
Hmm.
So I have, you know, I have characters on the fourth, fifth level of a mega dungeon, and they can pretty much depend that it's mostly empty once they've emptied
Interesting.
It.
Interesting. So I usually solve that by adding extra entrances. Like you noticed in the birthday game, there was a separate secondary entrance. You can skip the whole top. But I was prepared to be like, all right, if they go back to the upper levels, full of goblins again.
Yeah, that's I mean, I like the side entrances in the lower levels. That's always super clever, particularly if you have like higher level characters come into a location.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a realism aspect of like how fast can a goblin population repopulate itself.
Yep. Right.
You know, probably a fairly small percentage per year.
I agree with that. Now, in the case of the birthday game, of course, I made a point of like several months had passed.
Yep.
Right. And because for various other reasons. My inclination was like, oh, the goblins haven't been raiding the roads because they're in breeding mode now, and they're holed up and breeding.
I was reading, so for the first time ever, I get to read Dave Arneson's classic work, First Fantasy Campaign, which is, you know, basically some of his notes from the earliest Blackmoor campaign, published by Judges Guild after he left TSR, I think 78 or something like that. And he, at least for wilderness stuff, he has this suggested very complicated system of placing wilderness lairs in every hex of your map, and then on an annual basis, increasing the populations by a die roll of 5 to 15%. This happens in the spring, randomly determined one of the spring months. Could be either March or April or May.
Yep.
Right. Randomly roll for which month this happens, 5 to 15%, and then roll for interactions between all the lair monsters in every hex of your wilderness map, and randomly roll for a month for the tribe to try to move one hex away, fight out the fight between them, and then if successful, then more monsters move from an outer hex in.
Fascinating. You know what? That sounds a lot to me like playing How to Host a Dungeon, which is a great game, and maybe Arneson was just having lonely fun there of...
He claims this will be fun, right? He actually writes basically what you just said. He said this can be an entertaining pastime for the DM.
There you go.
I really doubt he ever did that. If you think about the logistics of doing that, to me that sounds like an aspirational maybe this could work type writing.
Have you ever played How to Host a Dungeon?
I actually haven't. I read it. I was on the cusp of doing it one day. I actually haven't done it.
It is, I would say, like mildly interesting once alone. Since then, I've played it a couple of times with one or two other people present, and that, I think, is really fun. But I would not sit there and do it by myself. Anyway.
And I'm like, you know, I looked at my wilderness map, which is a fairly restricted island location, and it's but it's got 330 hexes on it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't, that's, and I intentionally made it really small to make it manageable. I'm like, I don't want to have to track and index in 300 monster lairs.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot. Especially when there's one monster lair every single hex, that also seems very dense.
Well, see, that's my smaller scale one. Arneson's suggestion is you should have between one and four.
Wow. Okay.
In every single hex.
Anyway, we have gone way down the rabbit hole.
So according to one of the designers of the game, monster population should only increase between 5% and 15% per year.
Okay.
So in the spring.
In the case I was talking about in the West Marches game where I'm playing, the players, I can think of one particular dungeon, the players walk through the first room or two, which is just the preliminary, like, where we put, where the giant goblin population puts traps and watches for intruders. They kill a couple goblins and they run away. Okay. I've still got a big-ass goblin population, so they run away. A couple, like, the goblins aren't going to, like, not protect their front door, right? That's ridiculous.
Well, that's a good, well, that's a different, okay, I would run that the exact same way. For me, at least, if they go in and actually wipe out the majority of the lair and the leaders and make them run away, then basically that whole section of the dungeon can mostly be empty.
Now we're getting on the border of, like, why haven't my players done that? So, anyway, that aside.
I strike that monster type from the Wandering Monster list.
Interesting. Yep.
And when I do that, I kind of think about Secret of Bone Hill, mm-hmm. which is unusual for having a specific roster of monsters that you're supposed to take the wanderers from. Do you remember that?
Yep. I've used and written adventures like that where an entry in the Wandering Monsters table is this monster from this area.
Yep.
This means there's one less if they encounter them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. Okay. Introducing players, though. We're talking about bringing characters in. So you
let me tell you a downside of my mechanic. Mm-hmm. Oh God, I've forgotten what the downside was.
Which mechanic are we talking about here? Are we talking about bringing new characters into the game? I'm gonna force us back onto this topic.
Oh, I know. Okay. Yeah. The downside of requiring, and so maybe this is intuitive. So the downside of requiring my players to get back to town is that every session takes up some time with that travel. So as they get started, at least where I am, it's 3 days from town to dungeon. I've got to roll 3 wandering monster checks. Depending on whether an encounter comes up, that might be 30 minutes of the game. And then at the end of the session, since I'm going to enforce that again, the players have to be cognizant of, well, it's like 30 minutes at the end of the session. I guess we should go to make time for the possible encounters we'll have to deal with on the way back to town.
Yep.
So there is a little bit of a logistical issue in each session about time, them having to actually plan time to make it safe for them to get back.
I've also seen, I don't know if you've seen this, but I've also seen the case of, like, we're getting close to the end of session time, and we have to do a little fourth wall breaking for, like, how do you guys get back? Why do you leave? Right? And, like, I guess we just leave. I guess
at the moment, I mean, for me at the moment, my players, like, they don't get their XP until they get back to town.
Ah, well, okay.
Right? Yep. So that's a hardcore motivation. And that happened on Friday night. They were like, we just got this enormous. So my players actually killed a dragon for the first time on Friday night.
Nice.
Right. And shockingly, none of them died. And I once again, I did my best. I dropped a breath weapon on them 3 rounds in a row. Right. Round 1, breath. 2, breath. 3, breath. Bam. Right. But they split up. They actually had their elite crew in a small group, and they said, we go at one side of the dragon in different directions. So I could only pop them one at a time.
Yep.
And I had the whole party down to like 5 hit points each, and they actually beat the damn thing.
Well, good for
anyway,
them.
So they had they had about the biggest treasure ever to date.
Yep.
And they were like, should we keep adventuring? And they were like, no, we're gonna lock down this XP. We're going back to town right now.
Right, but that's you can't really predict that flow is going to happen, right? Like, it could be that they're having more lighter encounters and it's just the clock is running out.
Sure.
And you're like, we were really supposed to go home. I'm tired.
Sure, sure. And then actually, and then Friday night, the awkwardness for us is that it was actually relatively early. So by the time they did get back to town, we had a whole hour left
in
our normal playtime. And then they were debating about, well, we could go back, but then it's going to take, what, 30 minutes of playtime to get there and 30 minutes to get back?
Yep,
and we they actually didn't bother to go back that session.
Yep, yep. That is definitely, I think, a downside of not just stopping and picking back up. We're way off topic. I'm going to force us back in. So,
but anyway, that's my mechanic for making it really easy for new players to get in.
Okay, wait, a downside. I have a follow-up question for you, Dan. Okay, so you have somebody who didn't make it in the past 2-3 sessions. They're coming tonight. The party is starting in town. How do you introduce the character?
You know what? So this happened 2 weeks ago for me. Someone brought a friend that I don't think I'd ever met before. And, you know, that's very hand waved. You have met these people. You know what it was? In that particular case, I said they have been advertising for hirelings recently. Mm-hmm. You've seen the advertisements. You've gone. You are a more experienced adventurer, and they've brought you on for a whole share.
Okay.
That was it.
There you go. Force it.
Yeah.
So happened to my Sunday game recently. Had two guests come up for the weekend or for the Sunday game, and the DM wasn't me. I wasn't DMing at this point. The DM decided to actually run a separate like 1 or 2 hour session just for the two guests prior to our normal game,
to
introduce them, have a little fun with them, and get them to understand the background and etc. Give them a little basis to the game, and then when all the rest of the players showed up, basically then just did a quick force. A very easy force in that particular campaign was I think, if I remember right, which it's a little hazy because he went so quickly at it, that we have this particular powerful NPC who has requested us to do a thing for her. Yeah. And she said, and I've procured these two. I know you're going to need extra forces, so I've procured these two extra people for you. Here you go. Go.
Great. Great.
Yeah.
Great. Great. Yeah. Is that just so I'm clear? Is that Mr. Salvatore's?
Yeah, you know, trying not to like be a douchebag and name drop, but yeah, yes, the special guest was Joe Manganiello.
Just so I'm personally clear,
the DM was Ari Salvatore. Yes, correct.
Yes. I'm going to force the name drop.
Fine.
Yeah. That's great. I like that. It seems elaborate to do the extra hour session.
It was, and I think that was more about just extra time to have fun hanging out together than anything else. But I don't know. It seems like an interesting tactic. I could see trying that. That's kind of cool. Do a little, even a one-on-one DM and player session of just to get that person into the, especially if it's like a long-running campaign, right? Like you've got a lot of world history for this player to acquaint themselves with. Yeah. Make them feel a little more grounded. Seems nice.
Yeah. For my one-off player a week ago, I mean, I gave him like, you know, I gave him a high-level pitch of like, here's a place, here's a thing, here's the mega dungeon. It's terrible. Everything's awful. And you've heard of these people. And, you know, go around the table and do the please introduce yourself kind of thing.
Yeah. Yep. So I've also done another thing I've done in the past. We had a regular game where, you know, occasional friend would pop in, usually for just one session. But the rest of the group was very stable. And our favorite tactic at that point was that we just had a favorite hireling. That was the loner hireling.
Yeah.
And when someone showed up, they got to play that hireling.
Yeah.
It was a very easy character for guests to wrap their brain around, so they didn't have to think a lot. They didn't have to make a character. They didn't have to just, here you go, dumb barbarian. Have fun.
Right. Well, interesting. My players actually suggested that a week ago with the guest, actually. They've got hirelings, and they actually suggested that, saying it might be faster not to make a character. But so it's 100% legitimate. I actually did kind of want a higher level character with the group that day, so I did actually have them make. And again, in original D&D, it's pretty quick. You know, the funny thing is the longest part of it is getting equipment.
Yep.
So you know, as you know, fifth edition has these packages you can pick from.
Yep.
In the class write-ups, and that might be something that I should utilize.
Yeah, that's definitely. I feel like BJ has done that for his Labyrinth Lord games, where he's like, here's a couple packages, just pick one.
Right. Right. Yeah. Potentially, I should probably do that. But,
yeah, it's not a bad
idea. As usual, I'm fundamentalist, and I like to do it the original way. So.
Right. Okay, so let's go to a more difficult, potentially more difficult situation. You have your regular group. You're playing your regular campaign that's been going on for a very long time. Someone dies in the middle of a session. There's still more than an hour of play left. What do you think?
So this is obviously the harder problem, I think. So we have seen, like, that's, so again, at the top of the show here today, that's the issue that we've seen other people make what seems like egregious errors on. Let me tell you what I go in a very radical direction on that. When I started out my current campaign, I said, new character is on the scene as soon as you can generate it. As soon as you can generate it. So the first session or two, there was a fight. They get in fights at, for me, second level. Character dies, and then that player is furiously rolling dice to make a new character, right? As we're going around the table, I'm like, if you have a character, when it gets around the table, you're in the fight, right? So they're furiously rolling dice and picking new characters. And, you know, granted my house rules, I was really pleasantly surprised that that my players figured out on their own the complete character generation process and did, in fact, manage to make complete characters in a single cycle around the table. And then there's just a new fighter that just runs in off stage and, you know, axes a bandit in the head or something like that to save the party, basically.
Is this, because I promised him we would mention it, is this Chicago Wiz's BAMF?
It is. I guess effectively. I guess pretty close to effectively. Now, I only, I was doing that a year ago. I only read his interpretation of that like a week ago. So I wouldn't have known to call it that by at the time.
So can you summarize his method for me, just so that?
So in the discussion of the 3 week problem, and so this gentleman, he does publicize his name. His full name is Michael Shorten.
Great.
And he does go by Chicago Wiz or the Chicago Wizard. He does a very nice series on his blog called the 3 hex campaign starter of, like, here's 3 hexes and there's enough ideas to run a whole campaign by. And so he just calls his policy the BAMF policy after Nightcrawler of the X-Men, of just, you are there.
Yep.
The end, right? You're a player at the table. You're here to participate. We are literally going to have no explanation whatsoever about why you got there. You're just participating with a new character.
Interesting.
So that's clearly the far end of that spectrum you can possibly get on. Maybe not everybody would be happy with that, maybe.
It's definitely...
But I think it's a good policy, actually.
It's pretty close to what I use. Now, what I do is a little bit different, but simply that if you die, I don't immediately pull you in right within that combat, even within that scene. But I ask you to make a new character, and assuming you're ready, in the next room, I find a reason for your character to be in the next room. Right?
Right.
Whatever it is, the next scene, right? Wherever the party is, wherever they go next, you are definitely there. And oftentimes, like, we're exploring a dungeon or whatever, if there are monsters in the next room, you're tied up in the corner. Something like that, right? That's the easy one, right? Oh, you're tied up in the corner. Yeah. But maybe the next room it has a puzzle or a trap or something interesting. You're in there. I don't give any explanation, but I encourage the player to give one. I say, well, the party's inevitably going to ask you why you're here. You'll have to explain that. Please do so.
Do they have their equipment with them in that situation?
Yes.
In that, like, tied-up situation?
Oh, in the tied-up situation? Yeah. It's in a heap in the opposite corner. Like,
okay.
Must have just happened, I guess. Maybe. Don't know. You again, like I just kind of set the scene, and then I totally lean on the player to explain it.
Right. Okay, interesting. And I agree. So compared to my, like, run in the actual combat encounter that I started with, that has a clear flaw in that basically total party kills are not possible.
Yes. Yep.
Because there's a nonstop stream of new characters coming to the fight, right?
Yep. That is a problem.
On reflecting that after, like, just like, I think 2 weeks, I was like, wait a minute, I can't ever beat them if that's happening. So I did modify it to not in the combat scene. So in the combat, you're out for the combat scene. And then for me, like right after that's over, I have them just walk on scene and go, you have been followed. You didn't know it, but someone has followed you all the way from town, like hoping to, you know, get some additional treasure. And now they walk in the room right now.
That's interesting.
And they're fully functional and they're fully active and, you know, can make decisions
and,
about.
And do your next. Do your players dwell on it at all? Or do they just say, yeah, okay, whatever, and keep playing?
Yeah. Yeah, the latter. Okay. Everybody said, yep,
see,
you got it.
I like there to be a moment of explanation, okay. Of narrative explanation. Yep. But and again, I like to make the new player do it because I know they're going to do a better job than me. I know they're going to make up something that is grounded in their own character. And I think as a result, they're going to feel more involved in what's going on, right? Like, now you have to come up with a reason why you are exploring this dungeon on your own. Was there another party somewhere that got slaughtered? Do you have some kind of quest, right? Like, please make those details up.
Okay, that's all right. Once again, that's I'm tight-fisted as a DM.
yeah. I love to make players do that.
Maybe I should work that more in. So,
you know, and if I got, and generally my players take me up on it, but if I got a player, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, if I had a player who was like, I don't know, I'm not sure, I would probably just pull out the motivation, what's my motivation table, and roll. Here you go. Here's why you're here. Now we'll figure, like, here's another constraint to your ridiculous story. Good luck.
The random reasons table. The random reasons for adventuring table.
Yeah. Oh, what's my motivation is my favorite table ever. It's just great. I don't know if you remember, there was a birthday game we played a long time ago where Max wanted to roll on it and got the, my parents have been kidnapped and I have to reclaim the holy star of Umam Garash to pay for their hostage exchange.
Right.
Like a whole chunk got added to that adventure because of that one stupid roll.
Yeah, right. That was delightful. That's great.
It was great. I had to do was scan through my module and go, okay, who's got this thing that he's looking for? this encounter. There you go.
That's awesome. Yeah. That's awesome. Yeah. What is the longest, like, for my mistake, like, I feel like as far as longest amount of time that a player was at the table not being active, maybe an hour or two for me, which I felt really, really bad about afterwards.
Yeah.
What was the longest in the past that you have glitched that up as far as having a player not active?
I feel like it's probably similar. It's certainly not a whole session, and generally I'm looking at 3 or 4 hour sessions. I've never had someone sit idle for an entire session. That's just...
Right.
I can't even imagine that. Right. So, yeah, probably about an hour.
Right. Yeah. And, I mean, again, that felt bad to me. So, like, the 1 or 2 or 3 weeks seems, like, really egregious.
Yeah,
I would recommend that DMs not do that. Like, the next time... Like, if you haven't... If anybody watches or listens to this and they haven't made that mistake, next time this happens, please don't have a player at your table inactive for 30 minutes. For more than 30 minutes max, I would say.
It's a good. I mean, certainly, I'm sure some people are playing much more narrative heavy games, maybe with a more serious tone, and they really are going to resist that fourth wall break, right? They really don't want to feel that fourth wall break. And
I think
if the player is bought into that, right? If the player's bought in as like, yes, this is what I want out of this game. I don't know. I see. Well, the funny thing is, let's go with the one example that we have a shared experience on, which is when I died from putting on that cloak.
Right.
I wanted to play again, but I did not feel like it was overly long that I was sitting out and waiting. I was content.
Okay. I felt bad. I felt really bad.
I suspect that generally most of that emotion is always going to be on the DM side of the table.
Okay.
I think the players are going to be a little more patient.
Yeah. I mean, I had a game at our house con last year that went at a right angle for other reasons. And there were clearly players that weren't getting the activity that they desire at the table. And it was, that was very, once I've definitely seen that.
Yep. I'm not saying that the players won't get there. Yeah. But I think like I took, especially if the death feels warranted, right? If they're like, not just terrible, terrible luck, but like, you know, I was in combat. I took risks.
Yep.
I lost.
Yeah.
The dice were against me. I think it's pretty reasonable. Like, oh, well, eh. You know, when I put on that cloak, I'm like, I kind of asked for it, right? Like, I mean, I know the risks when I try an unknown magic item out. Like, I know the risk. Now, that particular payout was especially harsh, but I think we're all pretty amused by just how harsh that particular item is.
There's a line from the original Airplane movie with what's the actor's name? Leslie Nielsen, right? Nielsen, there's a line of a TV commentator saying they knew their risks when they bought their tickets. I say, let them crash. I think I've used that as a meme at least once, like in a D&D discussion or something like that. I'm like, oh, you know, my players decided to go fight the dragon horde. Like, I'm really worried they might die. And I'm like, they bought their ticket. I say, let them crash.
That's great.
I have a friend. I have some friends that I used to play poker with 15 years ago. And one of my good friends has a saying, it's good to have chips. It's good to be in the game to make a decision. And like, you know, with poker or like classic, you know, classic board games, you can be out. But in that case, you're out permanently and then you can just leave.
Right.
Right. You can just leave.
Yeah.
And in a role-playing game, there's possibly this awkward, like, do I get in or do I not? Maybe that wasn't communicated clearly. We didn't, you know, maybe that wasn't a thing dealt with in a session zero or something like that.
Yep.
So.
Okay, let's talk about, before we run out of time, let's talk about convention games, because I totally prepare for this for convention games always. Always.
Yeah.
And you'll remember this from when we ran the game where you played the adversary and you got to be the big dragon. I'm usually sitting no more than 10 people on the outset of like number of people at the table.
Yeah.
And I'm generally always show up with at least 16 characters in a folder.
Yes.
And I specifically tell my players that as I'm passing out the characters, I tell them there are more characters here than our players. Partly that's so that there's a good variety for you to choose from, and partly that's so that we can have a team B when you die.
Right.
And in your game, if you remember, I specifically, and I think we even had a couple players where this happened, they died. I said, great, go through the pile, and your character will show up. Now, I didn't quite BAMF, but I think I posed that one of, you're going down into this tunnels on this mountain, there's a base camp. The whole group of 16 people is at that base camp. A couple people are maintaining the camp.
Right.
And then, you know, they realize, you know, things are going badly. And one or two of them might run in.
Yeah. Great. It's interesting. So I'm going to run a game in about an hour and a half as I look at the clock here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have at least one brand new player. And so I'm going to have the more knowledgeable players roll PCs on the fly, like they do, and at least for the new player, I actually went and used the tool on your blog to make random PCs and printed out a stack of, I've got four PCs basically just for the new player to be able to roll in when they want to. So this is good. I should do this base camp story as I get started specifically for that.
I think that helps, right? Of sort of knowing, and I've had players try to do that on their own recognizance, a player who is like, I'm going to hire a whole bunch of an entourage to follow us around and maintain camp whenever we go into dungeons. Yeah. That way they can watch our horses and stuff. And then if someone dies, maybe someone from the entourage steps up.
Yeah, that's great. That's a great usage of it. Again, my players resisted hirelings for like about a year, and then they saw one of what they listened to one of our shows, and then they flipped on it. And now I think they have at least three or four hirelings running around.
That's great.
Yeah. And then they were looking for someone to run their new household actually. And interviewed a couple people and they were like, well, let's just hire everybody. Let's hire all of them and we'll make up new jobs for them because they're all kind of interesting.
That's great. That is great.
Yeah. I should say that, like, with my before we wrap up, the you know, I was saying that for me, I between sessions at least, I have people come back to town. The one thing that doesn't work for is wilderness adventures. So if someone is trekking on a wilderness adventure far away, I actually do suspend time in the wilderness. And once again, all this is actually explicit in the original D&D rules. It actually specifically says, go to a dungeon, you come back, it took a week, then real time flows. In the wilderness, time is paused. So I have had people off in the wilderness, and I've had to pause time. And then again, I make up some story. You know, the next session, player A is gone, but player Z shows up for the first time.
Yep.
And I have to make some story of side quest for player A, they disappear, and then some guides come in with player Z.
I mean, we've had the absenteeism question come up before, right? Because it is sort of almost a different flavor, or maybe the other side of the coin here is the, what do you do when a player's just not there?
You're right.
But yeah, it's a problem. I guess anytime you're forced to break the fourth wall, you know, how do you do it gracefully is the question.
Yeah. I'm pretty well. Nowadays, I'm pretty willing to shatter it on that that particular issue. Particularly, you die in session, you need a new character to be active. I'm very boot in the face on the whole.
Yeah, I'd say I'm most extreme about it in conventions because I'm like, you have exactly 4 hours with me. We may never see each other again. You paid
That's
to be
a great
here.
Point.
You deserve a 4-hour game.
That's a great point. Yes. Yes. You know, one thing I've been thinking about, one thing that's occurred to me lately is the difference in player number. Is like, I think that many of us agree that like home games tend to have 4 or 5 people on average, and convention games tend to have about twice that, tend to have 8, 9, 10 people or something like that. So I've started to think about like if historically that hasn't been a major issue for adventure design. About that there's pretty much a 2-to-1 ratio between expected number of players at home versus in a convention.
You know what this brings to mind? Sorry, there's a whole separate thread here of just like, what if you're not playing D&D? Okay, so let me I quickly am thinking about, as you talked about number of players, I started thinking about the Cthulhu games or the horror games that I run at conventions. Those are not for 8 or 10 players. Those are usually for 4 to 6 is my target for those adventures. And I state very clearly at the beginning of every one of those, my goal is to provide you a means to either go insane or die nobly or horribly before the end of the session. The stated goal of the game is that all of them end up there. So a lot of times those games do have moments where somebody dies a little earlier, someone goes insane a little early, and there's maybe still an hour or half an hour of play left, in which case, absolutely not. I don't roll them in at all. That's counter to the point of the game.
Okay,
but I would say the interesting thing is at that point, the narrative is so important and so interesting that the players stick around to see what happens because that's interesting, and they just become observers.
Okay,
and I don't feel bad about that at all. I feel like they're still getting their money's worth. They got to go out with a glorious, you know, death or a wild, insane, you know, scream, and they had their thrilling moment on camera.
Right.
And now they get to see the rest of the players do that.
That's a really interesting different context and perspective. Have you ever had, do people in those games ever die in the first hour out of 4?
No.
No. Okay.
That's never happened. Okay. That might just be because of the typical arc of those games. Usually the first 2 hours are kind of not very dangerous, right? They're usually much more mundane and we still think there aren't horrors in the world, maybe, and we're just doing our normal. We're just policemen investigating a perfectly normal situation, something along that lines.
So it's rare to have like the first room be like giant centipedes with instant lethal poison.
Totally agree. Yep. I can't think of a single horror game I've ever run where that happens.
Gotcha.
That does not happen.
That is very different from D&D
as
played by traditionalists.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. Now, I have had a player die with still an hour of play left.
Yeah.
Like their character did something crazy and, you know, really brave, and it went horribly for them. And the fun thing is the rest of the players then got to role play out the horror of watching this character die.
Right.
And still had a whole hour to dwell on, like, oh my gosh, you know, you killed Kenny. And, and I think everyone enjoyed it. Maybe it's just that group, but certainly both the player who died and the rest of the players all enjoyed the death scene and then playing out the remainder hour with that person being just an observer.
Right. I feel like an hour is reasonable. I feel like an hour is within the reasonability zone.
Yeah, I don't know what I would do if that happened in the exact middle of the game. If we're talking about a four-hour game, if it happened at the end of the second hour, there's still 2 hours of play left. What would I do for that player? I don't know.
That seems like a dilemma.
It is a dilemma.
Yeah.
A dilemma I fortunately never had and only have here in theory.
Interesting.
I don't know if that's by luck or by machination.
Interesting. If it was D&D, you could imagine. I mean, you could at least imagine a mechanism where everybody who dies becomes an adversary and tries even harder to kill the people who are left. But of course, that wouldn't work in all games or for all players. But
you know what I did do once? Now I'm remembering. I had a character die fairly early by being decapitated. And their head rolled along the ground, and another character saw this, and that was the trigger of watching the decapitation for the second character to go insane.
Right.
And we're using my insanity cards, and the insanity they got is delusions. Someone who has no business being alive or around you see all the time. And so scooped up the head and just started talking to the head. And so we, all the three of us, agreed, like, oh, you're going to roleplay the severed head now. And that's how it went, right? And so, and he could only talk to this one other player because they were the only person who heard the head talk. But it was great. It was great. It worked really well.
That is brilliant. That is great.
Yeah.
That is super.
Yeah.
Interesting. Boy, that's one I wouldn't have thought of. That's great.
That honestly was not even mine. Like, the two players came up with it.
Okay.
They came up with it through the playing the cards and the situation of the decapitation. They're like, oh, how about you roleplay the head from here on out? And the other
players, you get really good players in those games. You get very good players in those games. Those are excellent ideas.
Yeah. That was a good one.
Yeah.
That was a good one. So, I would probably do that. I would probably look for some excuse for them to play some secondary character.
Yeah.
You know, maybe a minor NPC they can play who, you know, also does something terrible.
Yeah.
I wouldn't even bother statting that character.
Yeah.
I would say, just roleplay this character, and I'm just going to arbitrarily kill you at some point.
Yeah. I mean, now, here's another thing I will say is, like, I've played in games that the DM works way too hard to make sure you don't die. And so I have been in some games whereby, like, my character is effectively crippled. And so technically I'm not dead yet, but I still can't really take any reasonable actions, right? I'm unconscious. I'm crippled for an hour or two, or I'm slowly paying out luck points to not die technically.
Yep.
And, you know, you're still kind of inactive and, in fact, worse because you can't get up from the table to go get a snack or something.
I've seen that in OD&D, right? First round of a ghoul encounter and I fail my save and I'm paralyzed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's tricky. Yeah. You're right. Good point.
Not sure that there's a solution to that.
Yeah. I mean, later edition. I mean, so, you know, like, right, since at least fourth, I think, you get a saving throw every single round for all those kinds of effects.
That is definitely the case in fifth edition. There are a few unfortunately, and I was just having this debate with some folks, unfortunately, it's not systemized. It just so happens that any spell that does that, it says in the description that you get a save every round.
Okay.
So occasionally an adventure introduces some, you know, here's a custom monster that goes with this adventure, and they forget to do that.
Okay.
And then you're like, well, this monster actually has a thing that will take me out of the combat for the whole combat with no additional saves. And some players get really angry about that.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's definitely.
Do you think that the anger issue is exacerbated because most of the other effects you get back real fast?
Yes, absolutely. In this particular case, the player, being a professional game designer, was like, they screwed this up, right? They didn't follow the design mantra of 5th edition.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm really angry at this other designer who made a bad monster.
Yeah, it's interesting because from my perspective, right, I actually have played two sessions in a 5th edition game with another DM who we both know very well.
Really?
and enjoyed it. Enjoyed it immensely because it's a very good DM, and again, a very good DM can make almost any system work well. And so we got jumped by ghouls last time. So we're going through a horrible underground dungeon. We get jumped by ghouls. And I'm like, okay, everybody, this is real serious. Get the elves up front. You know, get some spears. It's real serious. Someone gets hit, gets paralyzed. And then I'm like, okay, no problem. We have 9 players at the table, actually. I think we can still do this, right? But it's real serious. And then that player gets a saving throw in the second round. And I'm like, what? The who, the what? And they're like, yeah, we get a saving throw every round. I'm like, well, what are we worried about?
Yep.
What the hell are we worried about? This is nothing.
Yep.
No sweat, man.
Yep.
But that's, again, that's my old school surprise with that mechanic.
Slight aside, the way they changed the blink spell is wonderful. It plays into that design mantra. It's the best implementation of blink I've ever seen.
The blink spell?
The blink spell. Do you remember the blink spell?
Sure. What does it do here?
What did it do in old editions? Maybe just gave you AC bonus or something, or made you harder to hit? I'm trying to remember.
Well, I think originally it like moved you around.
Moved you around. Okay.
Yeah.
So the new implementation is at the end of every round, you roll a d20. And on an 11 or higher, you enter the ethereal plane. And you are now ethereal. And only people who are on the ethereal plane or can see the ethereal plane can even see you. And at the beginning of your next turn, you reappear within 10 feet of where you disappeared.
Oh, that's nice.
It's kind of neat. So you get a little teleportation. Nice. You get the benefit of, like, actually, I'm somewhere where I can't be hurt for a whole go round the table.
Interesting.
But there's only a 50-50 shot every round that it works.
Interesting.
And so that's, it's kind bad. Of like a little, hope it works.
You know, I actually always struggle with how to run phase spiders in classic editions of D&D, and actually that's not a... I might actually take that and add that to how to handle...
It's a great mechanic, and my character uses it a bunch, and it ended in hilarity recently where I had the spell going and I got knocked down, and so now you're going into death save land in 5th edition.
Okay, yep.
But the spell's not concentration, so it's still active. Okay. And I'm disappearing, and players are running around trying to save me. And I'm like, oh, this is just wonderful. I love this game. This is great.
Is the reappearance location random, or do you get to pick that?
So if you're... The way the DM ruled it, I can't remember if this is in the text or not, but the way he ruled it was, since that I was unconscious, he was just going to randomize.
Great.
Within 10 that feet, is, right? Right? Within 10 feet of my previous location.
Absolutely correct.
Yeah. Yeah, so the players started gaming that and like, oh, I'll stand here and you stand there and you stand there, so hopefully he'll be within reach.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah. I mean, so that's one of those things where by like a ruling on the fly, and okay, now we're way off topic, but I find that like rulings, many things on the fly that come up in the game are so much better than if I had sat at home for a month trying to come up with the correct ruling. Yeah. So as I put on Twitter in the game on Friday, the characters have found some magical healing mushrooms, right? And so I don't let people drink a potion in melee, right? That's prohibited in my game. And go, they're just going to knock it immediately out of your hand for free and smash it if you try to do that.
Okay.
And so one of my characters says, well, with a magic mushroom, can I eat that in melee combat and and not have them knock it out of my hand? And I go, no, you're trying to break that rule. Yeah. No. And then one of the other players says, well, can you put the mushroom in your cheek right before combat, right? And hold it in your cheek, right? And then swallow it when you need to, like, for free. And I'm like, And then somebody else says, well, except maybe if you roll a natural one, you choke on it. And I go, that's the rule.
That's great.
That's 100% the official OED rule for magic healing mushrooms held in your cheek before combat.
I mean, to the same degree, couldn't I, like, take my healing potion and put it all in my mouth and me?
No, you can't breathe or anything like that.
Breathe through my nose. I can breathe through my nose with a mouthful of water.
Yeah, okay, maybe. And then you can't talk. And you cannot
You can't talk. And on a one, you go.
Right, exactly, right? Including telling me what your action is. As soon as you tell me what your action is, your character spits out. does a magic motion spit take.
That's great. So good. Okay.
Thus saith the magic mirror. Yeah. Murky mirror.
I mean, this is... Yeah, yeah. So that stuff's great. That stuff's great. I mean, I was, again, listening to Critical Role recently. I saw a player use Mage Hand to deliver a magic potion across the battlefield. Yeah. And Mercer had the player who was receiving the healing potion save versus having his teeth broken by having a... Right. Like, oh, that's great. That's so good. What a good ruling that was. Here comes a potion. Oh, God. Right in my face.
That's pretty good. I think I would have rolled just to see if it gets spilled and just like dribbles it all down your chest or something, like your tabard or something like
save,
that.
Save versus broken teeth.
That's
love it. Okay, we're so far off topic. Okay, do you have any final thoughts on introducing new characters to the game?
It's a surprisingly tricky problem, and I think that many of us have tripped up over this. The 1 or 2 or 3 weeks of inactivity is clearly egregious, and I think if you're a newish DM and this shows up in the future, this is a moment you ought to break the fourth wall. A human player at your table should get back in the action pretty soon. Break the fourth wall.
I agree. And I think it seems like we've kind of organically come upon like an hour as being the uppermost limit of what you should find acceptable.
I agree. Yeah. You can be an observer for that long. It's getting a little downtime to feel the expiration.
Yep.
That's okay. I agree. Maybe 30 minutes to an hour, that's okay-ish.
Yep. And definitely situational. Is it a campaign game? Is it a convention game? Is it a horror game? Is it an adventure game?
Is it early in the session? Is it late in the session?
Late in the session. All important factors. I do, and I think if you can, let your players know what the rules are up front. If you can, that helps a lot. I find that super helps in my convention games where I just
out and out
tell them, here are these extra character sheets. This is what they're for.
Yeah.
So they know. Honestly, the funny thing is it probably frees them up to behave a little more recklessly. Recklessly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep.
That's the word I'm looking for. They behave a little more recklessly because they know there's a
safety
net.
That makes sense. But they have knowledge of there is a mechanism for them to get back in the game. Yeah.
Cool.
Good point.
Great. So if you have any stories of introducing a character to the game late, how that went, or other techniques you've used to make it make sense and perhaps be less painful on breaking the fourth wall, please let us know. Drop a comment here, and we'd love to hear from you.
That's great. And remember that you can follow us now on YouTube and Twitter and Twitch, and we have the handle Wandering DMs on all of those sites. We also have our personal website, wanderingdms.com, where you can download audio podcastable versions of all of our shows now, which is great. Also, look for our Patreon, Wandering DMs, and thanks to our patrons for supporting the show for that. Remember, we are live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, so please come back in 1 week and join for another thought-provoking discussion. We'll talk to you next time.
We'll see you then.